Hurry into Menards and save big money. Stock up on water softener Salt for softer skin and cleaner clothes. Diamond Crystal is the perfect choice of salt to minimize water softener tank residue. It helps your soaps and detergents clean better while increasing the life of your appliances and plumbing. Save big on Diamond Crystal products at Menards. And don't forget to check out the flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Hey, welcome everyone to the From the Shadows podcast. I'm your host, Shane Grove. And for all our longtime listeners, still no Jason, the super producer, but he did get out of the hospital. He is feeling a little bit better, but he's still a little tired. So we're hoping to coax him back onto the airwaves for next week's podcast. I know a lot of people have still been checking up on him, and he's really thankful for, like I said, thankful for everybody's concern. And he said he can't wait to get on here and give his standard greetings. You know, I can't do it with the same kind of manliness that Jason can, but I won't even try. But we appreciate everybody's concerns, and like I said, Jason, let's keep our fingers crossed, keep praying, and that he'll be back with us on next week's show. So, with that being said, I just want to remind everybody that if you do have a story you want to tell, please get a hold of us on our Facebook pages, the From the Shadows podcast page or the After the Shadows forum page on Facebook. Or you can find me on Instagram at Shane Grove Author or our From the Shadows podcast Instagram and our website, From the Shadows podcast. There's a contact page. All those ways you can get a hold of me and tell me what kind of story you got, because we get them all the time, and we love to talk to everybody about their eyewitness accounts. And so feel free to get a hold of us. We'll definitely love to talk to you. So with that being said, our guest today is somebody that he's kind of tied into a couple of our former guests. And we're excited to have him on. So if you guys have listened to the happy story from Georgia and Johnny Two Bears story from Georgia, you'll remember them mentioning this fine gentleman with us on the podcast from Georgia is none other than Captain Joe. Captain Joe, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you for having me, Shane. Good evening.
Hey, we're super excited, because all Happy's been telling me for, God, months and months, you got to talk to Captain Joe. You got to talk to Captain Joe. You got to talk to Captain Joe. And we'll get into it a little bit later, but because okay. we'll tease the audience a little bit that you guys actually a couple weeks ago got to go back and visit the place that Happy had his encounters so many years ago.
We did.
And I mean, I've heard some of the stuff, and it's pretty exciting. So but I just want to first why am I calling you Captain Joe? I mean, I want to know why I'm calling you Captain Joe.
Okay. Well, quite simply, you know, so I'm a retired infantry officer from the United States Army. My retirement rank was captain. And you know, it just seemed like a very easy title to use, just because, you know, I was so used to using it in the military. So,
well, Captain Joe, first and foremost, thank you for your service. I know you've sacrificed more than just your time and for the country. Okay, I don't know if I don't know if maybe you want to go into like some of what happened during your service, and you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess it's, you know, quite simple. You know, much like the little emblem logo that you used on Skype to find me, right? It was a Bigfoot with a prosthetic leg.
You know what? By the way, that is fantastic merch right there. I mean, I follow Captain Joe shirt with the prosthetic leg Bigfoot. That's fantastic.
Yeah. So I was at Walter Reed and a good friend of mine. We served at the 82nd Airborne. Show me that logo. Next thing you know, I had a box delivered to me up there with all these T-shirts of this, the Sasquatch with a left prosthetic leg. And so for the listeners, I was a platoon leader back in 2009 in Iraq, so September 2009 was wounded by an IED. Was subsequently medevaced, medically evacuated to Landstuhl, Germany. When I got to Germany, began kind of like the whole medical hospital process of trying to fix my leg. So I spent about 30 days in Germany. I was to the point where I was not, obviously not able to go, be returned back to my unit, but they had to get me stabilized enough to be able to make the long trip from Germany back to Andrews Air Force Base here stateside. So when I did make it back here, landed at Andrews and then off to Walter Reed, National Medical Center up there in Bethesda, Maryland. And then from there, I was able to be returned back to Georgia, where I live now. But, through the years, I've had multiple surgeries on my left lower leg to, try to keep it. So, I was considered a limb salvage patient at the time, so they obviously they can amputate your leg right then and there, at the time of injury or shortly thereafter. I chose to keep it. I did not want to lose my career because of the amputation. But unfortunately, my leg got worse through the years, and then finally I was actually on an elk hunting trip in Montana, not this past October, but the October prior. And, I just shot a big bull elk, down this very steep mountain, snowy mountain. And, I physically couldn't go get down this, down the side of the mountain, go put my tag on it. And, my guide and a caretaker friend that came with me went down there to go do it. And while they were down there dealing with my elk, I got on the phone on the side of the mountain, called Walter Reed, and just kind of told him, I said, look, I think I've come to that point where I realized that this leg is not doing me any good. And I requested to leave Montana and go straight to Maryland to go through the protocols for an elective amputation. I was there in November. They scheduled the actual amputation surgery in early December. I go back up there and had to get a COVID test. By now, COVID was a thing, and somehow I was positive COVID test, and kind of had a laugh because I felt fine, no symptoms, nothing whatsoever. End up having to rent a car, drive all the way back to Georgia, because I couldn't fly. Then they said, well, when would you like to come back up? And I'm like, well, early January is fine. So we went back up, my wife and I went back up early January. So my amputation surgery was on January 6th, which happened to be the day of the Capitol riots or whatever people want to call it, 8.5 hours after being under the table, I'll wake up in recovery, and you know, I see on the news they're in Walter Reed, the Capitol, police, and all this stuff going on, and you know, I was still all drugged up, and I was like, oh great, you guys started another war without me. I spent 3.5 weeks there in there at Walter Reed, and then they made a deal with me. If I promised not to do anything stupid, they'll let me go home to Georgia for a few weeks. And then I went back up in February for the surgeon, chief surgeon there, to, you know, review, you know, my wounds and whatnot. And as soon as he signed off that I was good, I flew from Walter Reed straight down to the Center for Intrepid in San Antonio, Texas. And I spent most of the spring there, doing my prosthetics and rehabilitation, you know, and then was able to come home in early May, walking, you know, on a new prosthetic leg, you know, so, everything's been good, you know, but, you know, I think, a lot of people kind of ask me, like, obviously how I got involved with the whole Sasquatch Bigfoot thing, right? You know, and I think, you know, before we came on, I kind of told you about the visual sighting that I had on the military base, and it stuck with me for a few years. And even though I tried reaching out to some of these well-known sites or individuals, I don't think these people really took me serious. So I'm like, okay, you know what? I just kind of shelved it, you know? So,
well, it's, you know, hearing that story. And I mean, I think that's important, you know, like here to hear what you have gone through, you know, to serve the country and to keep, you know, what we all take for granted, that we can, you know, be free and listen to Bigfoot shows and you know, go Bigfooting and mm-hmm. Sasquatch, ghost hunting, whatever it is. I mean, there's real stuff going on other places in the world that are
exactly
that our men and women are dealing with, you know, whether it's physically or emotionally, years and years late, you know, never leaves them. And yeah. I mean, I think it's important for people to have heard that part of your story as much as it is for them to hear this next part of the story. Now, I will say on a lighter note that having talked to Happy and Johnny Two Bears, I know why they take you Bigfooting, because they know when it gets real tough, they're just going to take out your prosthetic leg and you're going to be left with in the wood when it goes down. I know what those guys are up to. But I think I have a sneaky feeling you could probably defend yourself just good enough that it won't matter.
I always think of that, not just because of the Bigfoot thing, but because you know, I've been, you know, very fortunate to, you know, hunt in some awesome places. You know, last September I was in the backcountry of Wyoming, you know, in an area where is very well known for grizzly bears and whatnot. And believe me, you got to think about your personal safety out there, you know, and, you know, sometimes, you know, bear spray does not work, you know, I mean, well, I take that back. I'm sure it works. I just don't want to be the,
you don't want to be the one trying.
Yeah, because you know, I mean, you talk to enough like hunting guides and stuff like that. You know, if the wind's blowing in your face and you spray the bear, now you got it in your eyes and in the bear, and now you're both on the ground and screaming, you know. I don't know. And then I always kind of joke. I'm like, who's to say this stuff doesn't taste like soy sauce to a bear? You know, yeah, you know what I mean? But you know, I think when we were out, at the location of Happy's encounter, I was the only one that was not armed. You know what? I brought a video camera, you know, all the rest of them, you know, they were all, you know, armed with something, you know, and, you know, I'm just kind of like, okay, you know.
Well, and then once we get into your sighting, I mean, it almost makes you think that maybe it doesn't matter what you go out there armed with, because it doesn't seem to be, it doesn't seem to be a deterrent.
So. Yeah, yeah. Well, that and, you know, I guess it's just one of those things where, you know, hey, I left my pistol in the vehicle, you know, our outing that day, or, you know, our field investigation, whatever, you know, I was more focused on toting a camera, you know, and you know what, I've spent not only a career, you know, in the bush, you know, I work in the outdoor industry now, you know, so I do it, you know, good part of more than half the year, you know, from hunting show, you know, and different locations all over, you know, so I feel, obviously very confident in the woods, but, you know, but anyways, my visual or my sighting and all that, I mean, it definitely makes you wonder sometimes, you know, and obviously that's how I got to meet, you know, Johnny Two Bears, you know, you know, and it's been great collaborating with him and Angie. And then, you know, obviously, you know, we've done our podcast as well and share stories. And, you know, they are what I call, they're 24/7 into the subject, you know. Mm-hmm. And I mean, every day, you know, and me, I'm like, you know, nothing's cool ever happened to me, you know, you know, I mean,
well, know, like, I yeah, so. Listen, let's let the audience think if nothing cool is ever.
Yeah.
ever yeah. happened to you. Yeah. So let's go back to your visual. When approximately did that take place then?
Okay, so 4 years ago, a very grueling and prestigious sniper competition had changed hands of ownership, and the new owners had asked me, with my military background and shooting experience and whatnot, what can we do to make this event, you know, bigger and better. And you know, and I've competed in the Sniper Challenge several times, and it is tough, you know. It's one of those competitions where they're expected to lose, you know, 60% of the field, you know, as being dropouts. So I knew that, hey, you know, we had to keep the integrity of this competition being tough, because of my military experience and obviously rapport with the brass, you might say. You know, I simply stated, I'm like, hey, we should bring this competition to a military base, you know, so I made several trips to different military installations to look at, obviously, range complexes and whatnot, and, you know, what type of logistical support they would have. But, you know, lo and behold, end up being able to work with the, obviously, the staff and the garrison commander and commanding general here at the military base here in Georgia. I won't disclose the name of the installation, just to kind of, you know, protect them from any you know, whatever, you know. And I'll also leave the name of the sniper competition out, but anyways, you know, this leading up to this event, which is held in January, you know, there's obviously a lot of pre-planning that is involved in this, right? So The nature of the competition is, you know what, it's 3 days. Competitors start on a Friday morning. They're expected, you know, so they're two-man teams, right? So they work together. And these teams are expected to carry all of their ammunition, their rifles, all their gear in their rucksacks, you know, or, you know, their, you know, large backpacks. We call them rucks in the military. And these, you know, these rucks weigh everything from 45 to 80 pounds, depending on how much they want to suffer, right? you know, if you pack light, they can expect to be cold and wet. You pack heavy, you're carrying it. You're right. Cause you got, you got to finish with everything you started with. Right. But so anyways, so the course of this competition, you know, teams go from point A to B, from B to C, C to D. And you know what? They'll cover up to 40 miles. Well, for the pre-planning of all these ruck routes, right? So all these marching routes, myself, my daughter, we would go out and walk every trail, you know, obviously using maps that were provided to us, you know. It was very neat that, you know, I was able to work with some folks with Garmin, you know, because one of the things that I wanted to do to protect the teams was to say, hey, if I tell you point A to point B is 4.6 miles, it is going to be 4.6 miles, right? Because the competitors are expected to be able to traverse that distance in a 7.5 minute mile pace, right? So, okay. So if I say, hey, you got X amount of time to get from point A to point B, you got to get there, right? So I'm not cheating them on distance, you know, and time. So having the assets from the military to be able to help plan this was great. Also leading up to this event was me volunteering time to help instruct some new competitors, some new soldiers that had signed up for this, but they had never shot shot a tactical precision rifle. Try not to use the word sniper rifle. And not at the distances that were going to be required in this event. Now, obviously, I've had lots of years of experience doing it. I was, you know, prior enlisted before I was an officer. You know, it was back in May, leading up to this, to my sighting, you know, that we had planned to do a training day on one of the military ranges there on the installation. And so we had three teams out that day. I was going to act as a spotter for them. So meaning as they would fire at steel targets downrange, I had a large Leupold Mark IV spotting scope. So this is the military issued, you know, spotting scope and, very high magnification, very high quality piece of glass. So is myself, and then I have the range staff, a range safety officer. His job was to conduct all the safety operations. So he would announce to the shooters that the range was hot, meaning they were able to shoot at the targets. And then after so many minutes of that, he would call the range cold, meaning they had to stop shooting, unload their rifles, and step back away from their guns, you know, not handling them. And then we would go look at their targets. So obviously, you know, so we started shooting at targets from 200 yards out to 600 yards. And as the shooters got more confident in communicating with one another and picking out targets and shooting at these steel targets, on the range, we, you know, we said, all right, we're going to go out to a 1,000-yard targets. And so, you know, we rode out there in these, you know, UTVs and painted the targets white. And so at that point, that's the impact berm. So that's the furthest point away from the firing point, meaning the firing point, meaning where their rifles were, where they were going to be doing the shooting from. We were 1,000 yards away, painting targets, and came back, you know, came back to the rifles, and those, you know, the teams were expected to get their shooting solutions, you know, based on that, on the distance and the wind. And as the range safety officer called, you know, the range is hot. I was standing behind them with my spotting scope on a tripod. And so I had teams 1, 2, and 3 in front of me, and I would tell, all right, 3, you know, 3, you're up. So team 3, they would shoot. 2, you're up. 2 would shoot. 1, you're up. And 1 would shoot. And I would give them a correction, meaning, you know, I could see where their bullets impacted. And if they were off, they missed the target to the right, I would, you know, say, come left, 0.2 mils or whatever distance it was that, you know, that they needed. And they would make a correction, and they would be able to fire again and hopefully hit the target, right? But in the course of all this, because I was behind the shooters and up above them a little ways on a slight hill, I had a little bit more elevation, so I could see over the impact berm. And the impact berm was nothing but a, you know, big mound of dirt, right, that a bulldozer pushes, you know. And so that's where your bullets are meant to impact, right? I mean, that's where they're supposed to go in the, you know, they go in the earth, and that's where they stop. Now, beyond that is what's called in the military, you know, we call it a small arms impact area, right? So that is a huge piece of property, huge piece of acreage that is mapped out to be able to, all right, if you shoot, your bullet's going to run out of air and gravity, and it's going to, you know, it takes over, and the bullet falls to earth a couple hundred yards, you know, away, right? Something I want to explain, like, to your listeners, like how a military range, most military installation ranges are set up. Imagine a pie plate, right? And then, or, you know, a pie in a pie plate. And you cut, you know, the individual pieces of pie, right? And now you got these little triangles, right? So, and obviously, as the shooters are the pie crust, right? They're on the edge, and they shoot towards the middle. Okay, so all the ranges on most of the bases are set up that same way, where the pie crusts are the shooting points, right? And the impact area is like in the middle of the pie, right? So all the bullets, you know, are supposed to land down in the middle somewhere, right? And that's you know, for safety reasons, obviously, right? You know, so you don't want to have a range kind of facing towards town, and some guy accidentally shoots his gun at a 45 degree and it goes off into some neighborhood somewhere, you know? So that's why, you know, rangers are kind of set up this way. Also, you know, for more safety protocol, there is a range safety office, right? So they are kind of like the air traffic control office for all the range operations going on, right? So if, you know, they're the ones that range safety officer, he communicates to through a radio, meaning like we, you know, range 20 going hot at, you know, 1400, right? Going cold 14, whatever, you know, whatever the time is. And he also tells people, hey, you know, he also tells that office that, you know, 3 personnel going down range to check targets, 3 personnel return, you know, So obviously there's a lot of communication going on, you know, again, for safety reasons. Well, in the midst of the shoot of these three teams shooting and me spotting for them, and I can see over this berm, there is a single fire break. You know, this fire break is just kind of like a dirt road. You know, it's made by a dozer, right? It goes down one blade length and it comes back that same blade length, right? And it just, you know, obviously there for, you know, fire purposes. And very clear. So that fire break is running away from me. So I'm looking down a very, you know, looking down a dirt road and it's running, you know, 2,000 yards away, you know, away from me. But this is where my sighting happens. I see this large, and I will say bipedal because it was on two legs, right? Thing, person being Bigfoot, Sasquatch, just nonchalantly take a stride and cross this road. Now I'm fixed on it because I see the movement, right? And you know what? I instinctively should yell, you know, cease fire, you know. So, but I'm watching this thing walking through the brush now, and you can kind of see it clear as day because it's not thick brush. It's been, you know, very well cleared out. You know, there's bushes here and there, some pine trees and whatnot, and I shout out to the RSO. You know, called him by name. I said, "Do you see that over the berm across the fire break?" And he's, "Oh my God, what is that?" Right? And then we both, and he yells out, "Cease fire" on the bullhorn, and all the shooters stop shooting, right? And we see this thing going for a few more seconds, and then it just kind of disappears into the, you know, thicker brush, right? And, but at no point did this thing run, duck for cover, you know. Now granted, you know, I got these, you know, three shooters in front of me, and then there's obviously other shooters utilizing the range, you know, to our left and to our right, you know. So there's a lot of gunfire going down in the direction of this being, right? And like I said, at no point did it duck for cover. Did it like jump to hide behind a tree? You know, it just kept on walking. And so the funny thing about it is, you know, the little logo, picture that I have there on my Skype. I mean, that's kind of what it looked like, you know, maybe not such long arm sway length, you know, but it was big. It was grayish brown. So now here we're kind of in a safety hold, right? And you know, we had to call the range control office and tell them that we had, you know, a personnel downrange. And of course, now they send a person out there to the range that we're utilizing, and you know, we are told that we were the only range in operation and hot that day. Meaning, so we're, you know, the only shooters using, you know, the base ranges were the ones that were in front of us there. And because we were using live ammo and we were shooting, they don't allow for any maintenance operations inside that impact area. You know, for obvious reasons, right? You never know if stray bullet goes down there. Well, so, you know, so it just kind of just, you know, that bothered me because, you know, in my career, something like that, I mean, that is a butt chewing, you know, and you know what, and if someone were to be injured out there, that's a career ender, you know, but you know, it just bothered me, and that this large thing. And, you know, and I saw it through this spotting scope, right? And I've, so obviously if you go to like the, you know, our Sasquatch Encounter Brigade, Facebook page, you know, I've posted photos of my spotting scope that I've used to take pictures of the moon with, right? And you know what? At high magnification, you can see the craters and the valleys of the moon through the spotting scope. I mean, it is just as good as a good telescope, you know? And so for me, seeing this being at 1,200 yards, when I can pick out craters and valleys on the moon, right, at how many thousand miles away that is, you know, you can't tell me what I saw in front of me at high magnification. You know, it wasn't a bear just happened to skip across the road, you know.
Yes.
And it did not act like a human, because you know what, even at that distance, with muzzles facing you and bullets coming in that direction, you're still going to hear, the rifle report, right? And anyone that's ever been in combat or not, they can tell you there's a very distinct noise of when you're getting shot at, you know? But this thing did not, you know, it didn't act like, you know, it cared. It just looked like, okay, I'm going from point A to point B, and I'm just taking this path, you know? We were able to take a side-by-side down to that to the area where the crossing point was. And unfortunately, there was a impression. But, you know, I wasn't thinking Bigfoot at the time, right? I'm sitting there trying to look for Vibram logo, right? I'm trying to look for, you know, that actual.
Think it's a guy, a person. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm trying to see like what logo is on the tread pattern of their boot, right? Yeah. Is it military issue boot, right? Yeah. But there was not enough. There was no tread pattern. It just looked like a very big depression. Now this is where I get to thinking about this was, and I tell people, I'm like, and this thing took a step to cross this road that I don't think Carl Lewis could have stepped across the road. And Carl Lewis, the
sprinter, the long
sprinter. And exactly, you know, because this was a very wide. And if a person were to try this, they would have to exaggerate their gait. If you kind of catch my drift there. I mean, it just would not be a natural human step, just because it was just too far, you know. So that was one of those things. I'm like, okay, you know, there's not no, you know, clear boot tracks. You know, they're like I said, just very soft, kind of sugar sand, and it was just kind of one very big depression, you know, in this crossing, fire break, right? I kind of let it go, you know. I got a lot of things to prepare for the sniper competition and whatnot, you know. Well, now the event comes on, you know, January rolls around, the event is happening, right? Now I've got 200, some of the best sniper teams, so you got all the different branches. You got, you know, Rangers, Green Berets, top civilian teams, a lot of military units, even had some foreign army competitors competing in this thing. And, so they would shoot from early morning to about 1600 at night, so about 4 p.m. right? Because in January it starts getting dark around that time. And one of the things that we had to do was the competitors, you know, they had to sleep out, right? They had to sleep in a bivouac, right? So that kind of brings on the suck factor of this event, was that not only are they out there all day in the cold, you know, January weather, now they got to sleep overnight in it too, right? And so we had a location picked out where all the teams would converge to this bivouac campsite at night. We would make sure that they all reported in. We had to collect all the ammunition from them, store it in a lockable building with a guard and whatnot, you know, just to make sure that no one went crazy in the middle of the night and decided to go shoot up somewhere on base, whatnot, you know. We had a sizable group of scorekeepers, staff, volunteers, right? People that ran the ranges, the scorekeepers, you know. So I had scorekeepers from, you know, the Army Marksmanship Unit, you know, some of the manufacturers from the industry, you know, from scope manufacturers and whatnot, you know. All, you know, all these people travel here, you know, to be part of this event. Well, you know, it was also my job to make sure that all these people got fed. So, you know, we had arranged for meals to be made, you know, from restaurants in town. And then we would have a person drive them to us. Well, so we had an operation center that, you know, we would do all this stuff at. And anyways, two females that brought us our meals one night, they asked, you know, if we need anything. They were on their way home, you know, so they left about 9:30 p.m. And now they're driving home on Range Road. And Range Road is that, you know, the road that goes around the big pie crust, right? You know, it's a hardball, you know, paved road. And well, I mean, they leave, and you know, about 10 minutes later, I get a frantic phone call from one of the ladies, and she's asking me, you know, like, oh, do you have competitors out on the range in ghillie suits? And I'm like, no. Yes, at no point in the competition did the teams have to do anything but ghillie suits, so they did not even bring them. And I asked why, and she goes, well, you know, she gave me their location, and her and the passenger said, well, a very large person in a ghillie suit just tried to cross the road in front of us. And I say, well, that's not any of ours. I said, because they're all the teams are accounted for and in the bivouac site. And because of the competition going on, there was no other training exercises or whatnot in, you know, in the range complex at all. Right. Just again, safety reasons. Well, so this lady, she just kind of said, okay, well, okay, maybe it was just a bear, because I think, you know, in her mind, she didn't want to believe what she just saw. Right. Mm-hmm. And literally I talked to her like last week about this. Right. And like she said, hey, it was a very tall thing on two legs in a ghillie suit trying to walk up onto the road to cross it. But as they were coming down, their headlights caught it. This thing did an about face and went right back in the brush. But it didn't run. I mean, as they passed by, it was still, you know, in the shoulder where the, you know, just grass. It hadn't gone into the thick brush yet, you know. And they said it was just tall. And okay. Yeah, so it's so funny, you know. So I went out to the location with them, you know, and I marked an X, right? And that was it. You know, after the competition was all done, I finally had time to sit back and think about, okay, and what did I see? What did these ladies see? And I get the map out, right? And I'm like, okay, the location is less than a click, right? And less than a thousand kilometers, right? From where I saw my visual and from the crossing point on the road where they had theirs. And so I do like everyone else, you know, and I go to Google, right? And I type in Bigfoot sightings in Georgia, and it brings me to a BFRO database page, right? And, you know, and so lo and behold, man, right? There's a listed in the county, and I look at the county, and I happen to see in 1979 on this same installation, there was a sighting. And as I read through this this report, they name off a certain land feature, a creek. And I was like, huh. Ironically, that creek is like 500 yards from the spot that I saw my sighting. And that creek runs right up to the crossing point of the road where these ladies saw their thing in a ghillie suit trying to cross the road at 9:30 at night.
Wow.
And, yeah. And you can almost draw a line. And so that's when, I started going on to Facebook and I start, and it's so funny. I reached out to one group, and turns out they were more of a social club, they really didn't, believe, they didn't even want to hear about it. I think they just wanted me to come out and have beers with them. But then, I reached out to some other, another page, well-known page, whatnot. And the guy just kind of blew me off. I'm like, man, I have spent 9 years of my adult life in Iraq and Afghanistan, right? I have seen some of the, another deployment to Africa. I have seen some of the coolest animals in the world. I have been in the Iraqi-Iranian border. I've been in the Pakistan border. And here's this guy that just, wouldn't even believe anything I'm trying to tell him, And, I've had
that has to be very frustrating. Sure.
So here's a guy, when I was wounded, I had Senator John McCain in my room, the former president. so I get this, I hate to tell the Facebook famous Bigfoot people not wanting to listen to me. So lo and behold, I happened to see a page about on Georgia Sasquatch and research. And I see Johnny Two Bears on there and I reach out to him and turns out he was a Marine. So as soon as I mentioned small arms impact areas, live fire, he knew. And any of your military listeners or even law enforcement listeners, they would know the severity of having someone downrange during a live fire on a hot range. And those things are not supposed to happen. There's too many safety protocols to prevent that, And that's what, kind of got me into this subject, it wasn't, a cool thing, I saw a thing for several seconds, through a spotting scope, and it was walking on two legs, and it didn't have a care in the world that bullets were heading that direction,
I think it's very telling that you and those two women, okay? That you saw very clearly something that was not a person.
Yeah.
But yet you still went to investigate it as if you were going to discover it was a person. Like you know what I'm saying? Thinking it was a Bigfoot was not, even though you could clearly see that it was not a person. It wasn't some guy walking. Yeah.
Yeah, it was not a person in uniform. It was, so the benefit that I had using that Mark IV loophole spotting scope is it has a ranging reticle in it. So ranging reticle kind of looks like, obviously, people see it in movies, right? Those scope reticles where they got little tick marks, right? So we use those ticks and hash marks to get a height and width of an object. And from that, you do a math solution and you can get basically a distance, right? So I saw enough of this thing to say it was, 1,200 to 1,300 yards from my location, from where I saw it. And now, if I looked at a 6 foot, you know, 6 foot being an average person, right, height, at that distance, they're puny compared to what I saw, you know. And but yeah, you know, so when the day of my incident back in that May, you know, when I went out to that crossing location, you know, believe me, I was hoping it, you know, it'd be like some soldier who was, you know, lost, or maybe a timber cruiser who was out, you know, running lines or something. But it wasn't, you know, there was no clue. There was no, like I said, I used, you know, the word Vibram. It's got a lot of our military soles, right, on our boots, or, you know, got Vibram soles, right? And they're pretty easy to identify. But there was none of that. And then, you know what, these ladies, you know, you can hear the, in their voices when they called, I mean, they were frightened. Right. You know, it was a mother daughter and they were frightened. Especially when they knew that we did not have competitors out doing things in ghillie suits. Right. And then.
Yeah. The first thing they want to say is it's a bear.
I think it's just they want to convince themselves that.
Yeah.
What they saw was not what they thought they really saw, you know,
because would you, let's be real. If you were driving along, if you're those women and it was really a bear, they wouldn't have called you up and say, hey, guess what? I just saw a bear.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's not gonna be that big a deal. They knew it wasn't a bear. And then when you confirmed that, you didn't have any guys out there.
Yeah.
Were running around like that. It's like, okay, well,
yeah, you know, so what's so funny is, so the next night when they came to bring out the meals is, you know, we're in this big room and one of the folks that were helping was, you know, Green Beret and big guy, broad shoulders, and I was like, can you point out anyone in here that looks about it, you know, what you saw? He goes, well, taller than him and wider, and it happened to be the biggest guy in the room, you know. And I was like, you know, I'm like, okay, and that dude's 6'6", you know. and I said, okay, well, I don't think that was a bear, you know. But I didn't want to keep antagonizing them about it, you know, just because I know they had to drive home again that night, you know. But but like I said, you know, from time to time I'll see them and we'll talk about it. And they still don't know. They don't want to admit that the whole Bigfoot thing, you know. But it is. I think they know, you know.
Oh yeah.
You know. And I couple that with the 1979 report, you know. From a soldier on that installation there, right? So this is a conversation I've had with Johnny and obviously with a lot of our crew is that, you know, if you you want to get lost, you know, not be found, man, what a great place of real estate than on a military installation. It's got like thousands and thousands of acres that are really untouched and unused, right? You know, you know.
Well, it's one thing to get lost, though, but it's another thing to kind of stroll mm-hmm. within range of getting shot. You know?
Yeah. Exactly. You know, and so that's what, you know. So I think about, okay, January during the competition, you know. We utilized so many different ranges on that day. We had so many competitors going from, like I said, different points, different ranges, right? So there was a lot of gunfire going on, right? A lot, mm-hmm. from all different directions. So at one point, you know, so hey, if it was me and I wanted to egress or escape an area that was all of a sudden getting lit up, right, or high activity, I would wait till the cover of darkness, right? You know, and I think that's perhaps what this thing was trying to do. It just so happens these ladies happen to be coming down the road and caught it, you know. But yeah, you know, it's kind of obviously very intriguing, you know. And then obviously, you know, when Mr. Happy Harris, you know, told me about his encounter, and I mean, it's you know, 45 minutes away, right? And that 45 minutes from is very rural type country, you know, farm agriculture type things. And then, you know, he's in that location is very agriculture out there, you know, private land owners with big sections of woods, right? He had his incident about 20, 30 years ago, you know, and it just, you know, it just kind of blows me away because I'm like, well, shoot, you know what? I mean, who knows how long these things could have been in this area, you know? So,
I mean, the picture that I get is that, you know, you say it's 45 minutes away by car. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But by the crow flies, if you wanted to jump down in a creek bed or follow a river or something,
yep.
You could probably get from the military base to where Happy and some mm-hmm. of this other land is, and it wouldn't take 45 minutes.
No, exactly. Yeah, straight line would be different, you know. Plus, you know, there's swampy areas. I mean, even the farm that I hunt, you know. Which I would say is like between distance wise is between, you know, the installation and Happy's encounter location. But you know what? There's a swamp there. Very large swamp, you know. And then gosh, you know, there's a swampy bottom area all near that area where Happy's encounter was at. And you know, so I'm like, well, man, what a great section, or you know, like a byway, you know, because most humans ain't gonna go walking through all that stuff, you know what I mean?
That's why they got roads.
Yeah, exactly. They've got their own private little road network, because you know most people don't go in that stuff, you know. And there's food galore, and like I said, you know, a lot of agriculture, you know, from even, you know, from dairy farms to chicken houses and stuff like that, you know. And you know, plenty of cover, right? So you've almost got all your basic needs met. So
now, do you so let's come to like the present here, like mm-hmm. You sort of, you were telling me about the land that you hunt on
and
take care of. Some of the stuff that and you didn't think it was that big of a deal. You
said no,
it
wasn't that exciting.
But, you know, I think our listeners will have a different idea.
And again, I told you, the farm that I hunt on, you know, it's 220 acres, right? And it private keypad gate entry, right? And then the adjoining landowner is a non-state resident, so he's, you know, lives out of state, you know, and he's got thousands of acres, and he's got an old man caretaker, you know. This individual only comes up maybe 3 or 4 times a year, you know. So not a lot of pressure there, you know. We've been very blessed in this area to be able to grow and produce some very, very big deer, right? I'm very selective on the ones that I harvest from there. And it's kind of funny, like my wife and, you know, my friend who who passed away. You know, his widow. You know, they say, you know, I just go out there to feed my pets, right? And but on this farm, you know, in the time that I've hunted in some of the areas which are kind of butt up against this swamp, and like I said, you know, this swamp travels for miles, right? And it's in a bottom area, bottom of a power line. I can only get a tractor down in there in early fall, just because it's so muddy and mucky. You'll get stuck. You know, if you don't do it in a dry week or whatnot. But every time I have taken the tractor to bush hog some walking trails, so I even though I'm an amputee and I wear a prosthetic, I still park hundreds of yards away from like where I'm gonna go hunt at. You know, I enjoy the walking in process, right? You know, it's good exercise too. I'm not scaring animals, right? So obviously I use a small tractor and a bush hog to, you know, cut some paths for me. Every time I do any type of work along that swamp area, things happen, you know. And then, you know, here's a good point. 2 years ago, a fiber optic company come through to down that power line through the swamp. You know, they brought all those big rigs that cut the limbs, you know, off of trees that grow, you know, inwards into a power line, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they, you know, so obviously, and this was like, you know, took them about a week. You know, so, but they left their equipment out there. Well, one afternoon I was out there and, checking on some deer feeders and game cameras and stuff like that. And one of the guys rides up to me on a four wheeler and, you know, started questioning me, you know, about some of their equipment, you know, and I was like, what do you mean? Because, you know, and he said, well, someone went down and tore up the instrument panel on one of their big dozers. And I said, man, it wasn't me. I said, you know, why would the hell would I do that? Because you guys are doing me a favor. I mean, you guys are clearing that whole area for me, you know, I mean, but the mistake is they left it down next to. So I call that spot the neutral zone. Right. And it kind of. Right. It's. I don't go there and they don't cross there. That's in my mind. That's kind of how I have to tell myself. Right. You know, like, hey, if you Bigfoots really do exist and you guys are down here, you know what? I'll give you the swamp. You just don't come across, you know, the dry land. Right. But every time, you know, whether that power company crew was down there or, I'll cut areas near there. Man, my deer feeder this year was torn apart, the legs bent. And so when I had to describe this is that, you know, it didn't just get knocked over, right? So here's mm-hmm. a deer feeder, you know, on three legs, but the legs were displaced 25, 30 yards away in different directions, you know? And then, you know, most of these deer feeders are big, heavy plastic things, and man, there's a big, big hole in one, right? And in the plastic, never even found the motor. The motor is gone. I had a cellular camera in a tree, almost 6-7 feet up on a tree. Pointing downward towards the feeder, that camera was ripped. The solar panel was torn, ripped up, and the camera was busted. You know, and you know, I've been hunting and obviously working in the hunting industry long enough that you can tell. Okay, you know, hey, raccoons chewed this up or whatnot, right? No, there was no little teeth marks. You know, I mean, this was like, this thing was beat up, you know, broken plastic. There's no weird little claw marks. And, you know, so this was back in June this year. And I said, okay, well, you know what? They were obviously, and I say they were upset that I cut a new path. And the reason I had to cut a new path through the woods is because, you know, now I'm on prosthetic leg, right? And I wanted to cut a path that was easier for me to walk on, you know, and that's all it is. I just happened to go through a section of woods I think they weren't too pleased about, you know? And on that path, you know, I found a dead Rottweiler. I mean, in the middle of the path. I mean, this dog could have died anywhere, but it was on this path, you know? And I remember taking a picture of it, sending it to Johnny and Angie and whatnot. And I said, man, I said, of all places this thing could have been, it happens to be in the, you know, so I'm using a bush hog, four foot bush hog. It's in a 4 foot path, right? And there's hardwoods to the left and to the right of me, you know?
It's not like it got hit by a car on the road and wandered.
No, because the nearest road is like a half mile away.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, you know, and it had to get through a swamp too, right? And so that's what so, you know, I kind of shelved that, you know, that incident, you know. I've sat in a deer stand near that swamp on a very calm day, and I've heard like large trees, you know, the whole saying, you know, if a tree falls in the forest, do you hear it? Oh yeah, you hear it. I mean, it sounds like thunder falling, you know. But you know what? There have been times where, you know, the best description I can say is, I've heard all these like, imagine giving a t-ball team a bunch of bats and letting them go play Jedi Knights, right? Yeah. And that's what it sounds like going on in this swamp, right? And you know, and here I'm trying to deer hunt, and I strictly bow hunt, you know, so I don't really bring guns out there, you know. And I enjoy, you know, the whole archery process. But anyways, man, I hear these things. I'm hearing big trees snap and fall over and stuff like that. Like I said, on calm days and whatnot, and it's always in that swamp area, you know. And I don't know, you know. It's I've had something like run through the brush at one point along a creek, and you know, my daughter and I were gonna we scouted out an area, put a new ladder stand, and all I could see was the tops of some brush being moved over, like, you know, the old King Kong movies, you know, like you see the tops moving. Yeah, I see this just rushing. And that, you know, and I'm expecting, I mean, God, dog, you know, something that big, I'm expecting like a cow to come running by me or something like that, you know. And this thing just goes whizzing, you know, whizzing by. And, you know, I didn't see a thing, you know. I mean, just because it was, you know, real thick stuff. But, you know, I was like, well, you know what? The foot strike on the ground, it wasn't a deer, you know. I mean, it didn't have itty bitty hooves. I mean, this thing was, it made enough noise on when its feet was hitting the ground. I mean, it was like, you know, like, gosh, you know, like football players hitting those tackling sleds, you know. I mean, it was a very driving sound. That is about the time I quit. I made sure that I carried a weapon because I had no idea. I had no idea what it was, right? And but again, it's like I told one of the guys, Joey G from Florida, when he came up, you know, for our field investigation over at Happy's place, was that, man, I like to treat this as my deer factory. I do not want to believe that I'm also having to contend with these Sasquatch, Bigfoot things out here, because, man, you know, I got my daughter hunting out there. She, She goes and sits in a blind. She walks back in the dark with a headlamp on, you know, and, you know, me the same, you know. But you know what? I hear more reports and read more stories and incidents from people, from all the different various sites. And I'm like, uh-oh, maybe there's something else going on. But, I guess I'm still trying to like, oh, please don't, you know, I just don't want I don't want that intrusion there, you know? So
it's kind of like the denial.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's
kind of like the denial that you experienced on the shooting range of, exactly. Please just let it be, you know, like, yep. maybe it is a steer that got lost and just running around out there and doing all this stuff.
Yeah.
Got a hold of the deer feeder and you know.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's definitely, definitely very, it makes you nervous, you know, and then obviously, you know, I gotta be honest,
hearing you say, okay, mm-hmm. everything you've experienced and been through, hearing you say that it makes me nervous, that makes me nervous.
Well,
thinking that you're nervous, because I mean, to me, you are a guy, okay, your service, the stuff that you've gone through, you work on a hunting show, so you're,
yep.
I mean, it's not like you are wearing a three-piece suit in an office building and don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
And if you're in a place where you should feel super comfortable and you're nervous, that makes me nervous.
So what's so funny is like, I think, you know, like I told you earlier, you know, I mean, I spent 10 days in the backcountry of Wyoming last September, right? And in well-known grizzly country, you know, I mean, I saw a grizzly, we were walking up a Forest Service road and, this grizzly was walking down it, you know, and we were on foot, right? Bear saw us and it jumped in the brush. It was about 40 yards in front of us, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's normally what happens when you see a bear, right? I'm very confident in hunting in grizzly country and stuff like that. But, man, I do not feel comfortable down in that swamp area. And it's just a weird vibe down there, you know, and it's, I think of like a military side, you know, whether it be a Sasquatch, Bigfoot, whatnot, they've got the home field advantage, right? They know the terrain, they know all the cover and concealment, you know, I don't, right? I do not have the advantage like that they do. Even the predominant wind is in their favor, you know. As a hunter, you know, I take that, you know, we all kind of have to play the wind, right? You know, but if I was a creature of some sort that did not want to be found, I mean, believe me, I mean, we have a smell. You know, humans and not only just humans, but Americans smell different than Middle Easterners, you know, and Asians, you know, it from obviously our diet. Right. So we emit a smell. I mean, gosh, you know, you go to ranger school. Right. I mean, everybody that, you know, towards the end of ranger school, their body just stinks. I mean, it is a god awful smell. You know, it's that. You know, your body's kind of eating itself and it emits this nasty, oily stink, you know? And, if I was a creature such as, you know, Bigfoot, Sasquatch, you know, I mean, yeah, you know, they've got some areas that I feel like, you know, that's kind of like home turf and they know it well. Johnny and I, we talked about this a lot, you know, even from points where he feels like they cross the road, you know, they cross at a point that is very advantageous to them, right? You know, in military, we try not to cross roads on long stretches, right? You kind of do it in a curve, right? Just because in a curve of the road, a curve of the road, right? I mean, it kind of limits your exposure, you know? And I think Johnny in his research area, he is starting to see that and understand that, you know, obviously the terrain features are playing a very, very big thing in what he is finding, you know, and it's always neat to talk to him. Like when he gets like 3 or 4 days off and he's out there, I mean, cause you know, he's having this stuff go on outside his back porch, right? I mean, his back door, and bam, it's happening, you know? And it's kind of funny because, I mean, I spend so much time over on the farm and all that. And there's a, you know, there's a cabin to stay at and all that and whatnot. And I guess that whole denial thing, man, I do not want to believe I'm having to share some woods with these things, but you know what? There is definitely enough evidence to make me say, okay, there is something here. There is something happening. You know, I mean, even to the point that, you know, Johnny kind of posted a little video, right? And you saw it, the dog skulls, you know, and it's kind of disturbing to me because, you know, and I want your listeners to, please understand, I am not a dog hunter, meaning like the type of guy that, runs dogs to chase deer, flush deer out, you know, that's you know, people do that, you know, but, you know, I don't do that on the farm. I don't even purposely go out and coyote hunt out there, you know, so I don't go out with the game calls and try to call coyotes or whatnot, you know what? If a coyote comes up underneath a stand, you know, I've got a bow and all that. I mean, yeah, you know, it's sometimes you do have to take that shot because, you know, coyotes and, you know, they wreak havoc on the, you know, turkey population and whatnot, you know, and the deer population as well. But, you know, I wanted him to see, hey, this is the little tractor trail that I cut, and this is where that dog was. And as we're walking to it, he finds a skull. And I'm like, well, that's not the dog. It's, you know, it's down here. And next thing you know, he's walked around and here's another one. There's another one. There's another one. And I'm like, holy smokes. So he got the 20 plus and all within the 120 yard, you know, radius. And, you know, gosh, you know, 150 yards from a pop-up blind, right, that I have set up along this food plot, you know, and all this is, you know, right above the swamp. And I do not understand what is, you know, like what they are all doing in that location, you know. You know, Johnny, I always sat there and we tried to think. I'm like, all right, you know, if you're a dog, you got hit on the road and it's a half mile away. What makes them want to go through a swamp, climb a big hill, and just expire right here? You know, I don't get it. Again, I did have to disclose. I'm like, all right, so there's a little spot not too far from there that, you know, I have left, you know, deer guts and hides, you know, in the past, after, you know, we'd take them to the skinning shack and all that, you know, but not a lot. You know, I mean, I don't shoot a lot, you know, I don't harvest a lot out there, you know, and, you know, first I thought, well, maybe I made them mad by, I'm not feeding them or something like that. Maybe they like the gut piles. I don't know, but, you know, it's not like I was giving them a weekly pile, you know, easy meal, you know. But again, right, you know what, it kind of goes back to, I cut a new path on a tractor, you know, through the woods, and within a week the first dog was found there in June. Now, right, Johnny and the crew come up here a couple weeks ago, and now there's skulls all over the place. It, dude, it's kind of weird, man. And I have no explanation for it. You know,
I mean, when I saw the video and talked to Happy about that, that is one of the craziest things. And I mean, look, I'm not a big outdoorsman. I'm not a going out hunting and stuff, but I still know enough to know that the chances of you finding an area where there's 20 plus canine skulls is not good. I don't know even unless unless we're talking about a dog pound somewhere that's euthanizing animals, and even they wouldn't just throw them out in the
like I said, it's a controlled access gate, you know, big wrought iron gate. There's no other access in, you know, and that gate's locked, right? You know,
a human being is not driving onto that piece of property dumping dogs.
No, you know what? I'm out there enough. You would be able to tell that there's some tire tracks, through the grass. You know what I mean? And there's none of that. That's what's disturbing, about it all now. So I went out and I set up three cameras all in that area now, to try to hopefully capture something. Johnny and I, we also have a theory that, these things can see, the PIR, passive infrared, of these game cameras, only because some canines can, like wolves, right? If they happen to have the ability to see this beam, right, then maybe they will stay away from that area, right? So now I set these cameras up, basically creating a wall, right?
not so much if you happen to get a picture, that's great, but the main thing is you're doing it as a deterrent for them.
Exactly.
Find some place else to do this.
My theory is I want them to know I know what they're doing, and that they are moving into my territory, right? And here's the line, right? You guys got the swamp, I got above it. So you start putting dog skulls up here, you're crossing the line. And I checked, cameras over the weekend, stuff like that. They're all fine. Two of them are the cellular cameras, so I'd get a image back to my phone here, instantly, So, it'll be interesting to see if this activity stops or if something else happens, So.
Wow, that's look. I'll be. Because I'm in contact with Happy and Johnny and these guys, so I'm definitely anxious to hear what transpires. And I know we don't want to give too much away, but I know Johnny's working on putting the footage together from you guys being out there a couple of weeks ago to go up on the Facebook page, I think.
Should be
pretty interesting.
It is. We did our investigation stuff over at the location where Happy's encounter was, for Scott to find tracks, crossing a power line. So when I say finding tracks, it rained the night before. We had a real big, heavy, rain front come through, right? So these things were pretty fresh. For him to find that, and then we kind of just followed the straight line, where the direction that this thing was moving towards, and then we've, you know, finding this. I'm gonna call it like a nest. You know, I'm not sure if Johnny or Happy shared the pictures with you, but yeah, it'll be on the video piece that Johnny's putting together. But it was, that thing was pretty intriguing. Again, because we had a storm and all that, you know, this thing was, like I said, you know, it wasn't scattered or nothing like that. I mean, this was something that was purposely done, you know, with pine needles, right? And there was an indention in there, indention in this pine needle the size of Johnny's body, because I made him lay down in it, right? And just because to get a representation, like, all right, something could have actually laid in this thing, you know? Like, you know, you tell your kids go rake up the leaves, you know, then they lay down in it, you know, but this was pine needles. And, man, you know, and then the next day Scott found two more. Right. And, I've never seen anything like that in the woods. There was, you know, there was no like claw marks or hoof marks to indicate like a known animal that we know did that. Right. You know, now we all know, you know, we know, like, you know, turkeys, they go through the woods and they scratch and peck all the time. But you know what? This would take about, you know, 20 turkeys getting in a, you know, 8-foot diameter circle, and they all scratch towards the back at the same time. You know
20,
what I mean?
20 turkeys with a sole purpose.
Yeah, exactly.
That doesn't happen.
No, it doesn't. You know, because this was, and this circle, this, I mean, this was too perfect. I mean, this was too perfect of a circle, you know? And, hey, man, I tell you what, that thing, just seeing that, I mean, that was like, that was a huge eye opener, you know? Because I'm like, I've not seen this on any of the Bigfoot shows, you know. You know, and we all have, you know, you sit around and we think, man, okay, why would they do this? You know, well, you know what? It's been cold, right? You know, here, and you know, what a good way to mound up some insulation, right, to sleep on the ground, you know. Or Angie had a really good theory about, you know, it could be like a spot. Maybe they put their young, you know, like one, you know, babies, you know, they sell them at stores, the little cradles that, you know, little foam things that you put the infant in so it doesn't roll off, you know, when you change their diapers.
Yeah.
So maybe something like that, you know, like, hey, it's just a safe, dry spot to put the young or something like that, you know, and, you know, I mean, there's so many different, you know, but, you know, things that it could be, but, you know, that makes sense too, you know? But like I said, I've not seen anything like that, you know, and I think when, you know, the video's out, you know, I really hope people see that. And I hope, you know, any of your listeners come back and say, oh, I've seen this, or, you know, they've found one too, you know, or they'll be on the lookout to look for something like that, because it is remarkable that not just finding, you know, one, but when you find three, now that, you know, that becomes repeatable, right? You know?
Yeah, it's not an accident when it's three.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, so. Man.
Well, and that's kind of, and just like you said, I mean, that's kind of the point of sharing this stuff and putting together, you know, the video evidences to see. Yeah. If this behavior or look, I really don't want to hear from somebody and say, oh yeah, I've seen places where there's, you know, I found 30 canine skulls. I mean, that's just not a pleasant thought. But some of the other behavior though, yeah, you definitely want to hear that. So you know that, okay, it's, you know, if it is an accident, well, mm-hmm. there's accidents happening all over, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're just like I said, I've heard similar stories from military personnel about seeing things out on ranges, and it just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. You know, I talked to a former ranger up there at Fort Lewis that, you know, had a incident of while they were on a range, and it's, you know, basically using up all the ammunition at the end of the training exercise, you know, because you can't turn in live ammo, so you know you just got to sit there and shoot everything into the burn, basically, right? You know, mm-hmm. And yeah. You know, and in the course of doing that, something was screaming and hollering, howling, and at them from the, you know, from downrange. You have to, you know, spook these guys, and these are three rangers, right? And
yeah,
you know,
like
because they you know, and you know, that's where I was stationed too, you know, so it's like, man, I know the exact range he's talking about, you know. But the thing is, all right, so now you got a young soldier and he's doing this, he's not expected to hear something howling and whooping at them, you know, from the direction that they're trying to, you know, expel ammo, right? So
yeah, exactly.
So and again, it's one of those things where they too had to stop, they too had to go make sure there wasn't someone down there clutching their guts, and you know, on, you know, they accidentally sent a round into somebody. It wasn't, you know, there was no one there, you know. So I'm glad that, you know, more folks are, you know, sharing these, you know, these experiences, you know, so.
Yeah. And well, I tell you what, I really appreciate you sharing this. And to me, your eyewitness testimony is not to discount anybody else's, mm-hmm. but your experience in the woods as a soldier. Mm-hmm. You know, that your ability to recognize things, judge distances, and just know what should be in a place and what shouldn't be in a place just totally makes your sighting so much more intriguing.
Thank you for giving me the platform to share, you know, with your listeners and about that, you know. Again, you know, it's you know, it is, you know, not a week goes by that I don't think about it, you know, because again, it shouldn't have happened, it shouldn't have been there, right? When you start putting the clues together, you know, especially from the another sighting, you know, from the late 70s, and then these ladies having their sighting, and you know, it's just too much in that one area. So
yeah, I hey, there's something going on in Georgia, but
you know what, I would have never believed it, you know. So I was stationed up in Washington State for 9 years, you know, and yeah, and you always kind of figure, you know, that's kind of like the ground, you know, that's the ground zero for all the Bigfoot stuff, but Georgia's got quite a bit, you know, and mm-hmm. But hey, you're in what, Ohio, right?
Same in Ohio.
Yeah, and Ohio's, Ohio's got some, you know, I deer hunted up in Licking County.
Oh yeah.
You know, there's some big deer there. Yeah, we filmed an episode out that way, and you know, there were some locals out there. They would tell me some stories, you know. I was like, oh man, okay. So you know what, it's almost everywhere, you know.
It is, and like, I'm with you, you know, when growing up you just thought it was only in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
And then since we've been doing this, it's just it's everywhere. I mean, people are seeing something, experiencing something, and it's not just their imagination. And like I said, you're hearing your sighting and your experiences, and you're the kind of guy that just knows what's not out of place.
Yeah.
And So I know, I don't know, but I still will, you know, watch going out there with Happy and Johnny Two Bears, because I'm sure that that's their plan, is they're going to leave you behind. So
that's probably.
But little do they know, I think you could probably wound at least Happy with a shot to the to his ankle, and then you could crawl out past it, if that's what you're
saying. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, well, Captain Joe, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
And I know our listeners are going to love this these experiences that you've shared. And when the stuff gets up that Johnny gets done, we'll be sure to share that too.
Thank you.
I'm sure everybody will be eager to see that. So stay safe out there.
Will do. Thank you.
Because I want to hear some more stories in the future.
We'll do. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.